Quick question from me and the Making Money team. Would you like us to come into your workplace to teach you and your colleagues more about personal finance? It's an absolute joke that we're not taught what to do with money, and this knowledge gap makes most people much poorer over their lifetimes. Take your work-based pension. Most people have no idea what the fund they're invested in does, and plenty of people just opt out altogether. We can cover whatever is most important, from the basics to complex financial retirement planning supported by qualified financial advisors who are not there to sell you anything. We take different approaches for different people in a company depending on stuff like their age or their income. Anyway, if you think people you work with could benefit from financial education, then please email Will at getmost.co.uk so he can explain more. It doesn't matter what your role is in the business, we want to hear from you. So email Will at getmost.co.uk.
There are certain periods in your life when you want a bond.
Do you invest in bonds? You might not realise it, but you probably already do. If you have a workplace pension, the default option is to invest you in both stocks and bonds. But is that the right strategy for long-term growth? Romin Nikisa from the Pension Craft YouTube channel and friend of the podcast is a big fan of bonds. Now that doesn't mean that he thinks they're always the right choice for the long term. And you'll find out why in this episode. But he does think that they're more useful than you might think.
As a way of planning your cash flows, it's incredibly valuable. You know, whether you're 20 or whether you're, you know, 80, it makes no difference.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. Yeah. Good to see you again.
Why we've had you back really is because you're the bond master and me and Tomei know absolutely nothing about bonds really. I think I know a little bit more than T,
definitely.
But not much. What we want to do today, because, you know, every time I talk to you, you say you think they're sexy and that you love them. We want to bring that out and see why.
Well, we'll see what we can do.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to start high level and then we're going to get deeper into it. And then we're also going to make it topical and look about like what happened with the bond market recently and why that was such a shock for the UK economy. But let's just start, first of all, the buzzer's here if T needs to hit it as
he
well.
Will.
Yeah. What is a bond?
Okay. So if you lend someone money, that's not tradable, right? If you lend me money, we couldn't then trade that with T. But for a bond, it is. So it's structured as a tradable chunk of debt. That's the gist of it. And that's it. That's really what it is.
Okay. And I know you've explained this before, but I think it's important that we do it again. How do the returns work on a bond that, say, differ to the stock market?
So let's say that it was a bond that was issued by a company, which was issued by your company, say. So you're the issuer of the bond, and you go out to the bond market and say, look, I want to borrow £1 million. How much interest will I have to pay? And there'd be a very kind banker who'd help you structure the debt. And they'd come up with a coupon, the fixed rate of interest, which you're going to have to pay. The dodgier your credit, the more interest you have to pay. That's the gist of it. And you'll pay whatever the government's borrowing cost is, which is a risk-free rate,
yeah,
plus a spread according to DAMO's dodginess.
Okay.
So that's the DAMO dodginess spread,
yeah,
or credit spread, as we call it.
Yeah, thickly spread, my dodginess. Yeah. So is this where you get your A rating, your AA rating, and a junk bond and things? Is that terminology? That's
exactly.
Scoring?
So the higher the credit rating, the smaller the credit spread, the dodgier the credit, the wider the spread. And as an investor, what you're always trading off is what's the chance I'm going to get my money back versus the return I'm going to get. That's the trade-off. So for a really dodgy credit, you're just thinking, oh, I hope it survives to maturity. Whereas if you lend money to someone like Microsoft, you're thinking, well, I'm going to get the money back, but the default risk is negligible. So this is just like free credit spread.
And sorry, quickly, who can issue bonds?
Generally, companies and agencies, sometimes governments do it a lot. And in some cases, governments do it too much, as we'll discuss later on, possibly. But any entity which is like a corporate entity can pretty much issue a bond.
So they don't have to be a certain size or have a certain revenue?
Yeah, although, I mean, you do get these kind of wacky things, which maybe we could talk about later, but things like Bowie bonds, where you take a whole music catalogue and you turn it into a sort of cash flows that go on forever. And that way, David Bowie got a big payoff for his music catalogue on day one. And the people who bought the bond got payoffs in future from
the royalties of the music.
Exactly.
Justin Bieber did that recently as well, didn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
I think they sell them for like hundreds of millions, right?
Bieber bonds.
Yeah, Bieber
that
bonds.
That sounds better, doesn't it?
Yeah. Damien's favourite artist.
I've mentioned him twice.
Yeah, I know you love
today.
Him.
Yeah, I do. Well, nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with the bond either. So the ratings, like A, AAA, B, C, could you equate that to risk in terms of, say,
at a B or a C, you're starting to get to a 30% chance that people might not pay.
Yeah, I mean, the cutoff is between triple B and double B. So that goes from investment grade to junk. So that's the big border between kind of good companies and slightly dodgy companies. So junk bonds will be double B and lower. Investment grade will be triple B and higher. And usually, if you buy a fund, it'll say this is an IG fund, investment grade, or this is a high yield, which is junk.
And my attitude toward, the reason I have such an ignorance toward bonds is it's always been like, well, at my age, I should just expose myself to as much risk as possible. I go 100% equity and I'll think about bonds in the future when I want to de-risk, you know, a form of lifestyling, as you might call it. But do you think that that's not the case?
I think that is a case. And in fact, my portfolio, my core portfolio is also 100% equity, although I do play around with bonds just for the sake of it. But I think at a certain point, I will be de-risking just before retirement and just after retirement. I mean, sometimes what happens is you get a crash just after you retire and you're forced to sell your stocks at a lot. Exactly. Yeah. So to avoid sequencing risk, I'm going to de-risk. Yes.
Sorry, what's sequencing risk?
It was his fault that time. Yeah. He said it.
I know, I've got to explain it. So yeah. It's this like, it's this, basically, if you're drawing on a portfolio that crashes in the first few years, that really impacts the longevity of that portfolio. You might have a better way of explaining it, but basically you're almost like kicking yourself when it's down. So the first few years of retirement are really important because if the market crashes in those few years and you withdraw in, you shave years off the longevity of that pot of cash, which is important because if you're retiring, you need your pot to last you until you're 90 odd. You
know? And what's weird, even the same size crash, exactly the same size when you're 90 hardly matters at all because you won't be around for much longer. So all that compounding is not going to happen anyway. So you
don't, a 20% care. Drop on a million is 200 grand. A 20% drop on 100 is 20K. So like the impact to you and your life and your ability to recover from that is high. So the sequencing risk is that.
Cool.
Does that make sense?
Thank you.
I just made that up.
Freestyling it.
Yeah. So, you know, some like me then, how are you getting me excited about bonds, saying like, to get me to look at them more?
So long term, you shouldn't be, right? So they're going to earn about 4% less than stocks over the long term. That's the last century of data which we've seen. So
is that the equity risk premium?
Exactly. The equity risk premium's chunky and it's consistent. And if you want to beat inflation, that's how you're going to do it. But there are certain periods in your life when you want a bond. So let's say you're going to buy a house in 2 years' time. Are you going to invest that in 100% equity? Doubt it. Because it could crash over that 2 year period. So if you're going to have a known payment in 2 years' time, so let's say it's, I don't know, £100,000. If you know the return of bonds is about 5%, and you only need to put like 10% less than that in today, and you know exactly to the penny how much you're going to be paid in 2 years' time when the bond matures. This is for a single bond, not a bond fund, importantly. So if you've got a known payment up in future, then as a way of planning your cash flows, it's incredibly valuable. You know, whether you're 20 or whether you're, you know, 80, it makes no difference. So not just de-risking, but for planning cash flows, I think it's really useful.
Yeah, it's almost like the target date funds and stuff do similar things, don't they? They have a set date and you know, I mean, they de-risk into it. But what you're saying is if you've got a goal of like in 10 years, I know I need X, kids are good for that, right? They're going to university or they want a house deposit. You could use a bond for that. Would you get a better rate in a bond than you would in a savings account?
It depends. I mean, you always have to look at the yield curve. So that's one of the things which is really helpful to understand is with bonds, they're different from stocks in the sense there's another dimension and the dimension's time. So if you're lending money to the UK government, say, you could lend it to them for a year, 2 years, 5 years, up to 30 years. And the rate will be different according to when you lend. Now, normally, you'd pay more interest, you get paid more interest if you buy a longer term bond. That's called term premium. So you get paid to take that risk, locking in a rate for longer. So there is that difference. And really, if you want to understand what you're going to get, you have to think about how long you're going to hold the bond. And holding it to maturity is usually a good idea because this whole thing about knowing exactly what you get only applies if you buy the bond today, hold it till it matures. Mm. And that's a big difference between stocks and bonds. With bonds, you never have to face the market again. You can just wait till it matures, you get your £100 back, and you get exactly what they promised if the government doesn't default, which hopefully they wouldn't, but that's very unlikely. So that's the way it works. And this maturity thing is really important to understand. So for a money market fund or a cash account, you're going to earn what's roughly the like 1 year or 6 month rate on the yield curve, which at the moment is weirdly high. It is unusual. And that's more than you'd get for 1 year, 2 year, up to 30 years. So you've got this weird downward sloping yield curve.
Is that when they talk about the reversing of the yield curve? Or yeah. Like the flipping of the yield curve?
Exactly. The inversion of the yield curve is usually seen as a recession measure. I mean, we can discuss why, but it is usually seen as that. But it is unusual. It's usually when the central bank's hiking rates, as it is now. That's when you get the short end moving up, because they control the short end. The long end is controlled by things like growth and inflation. So that's, say, pretty much anchored. And then, you know, the long end, the short end's kind of moved up like that. So that's why it's inverted.
If you take, I assume if you take out money from a bond early, you get hit with you get a fine or not a fine, a penalty, or can you not take it out early?
It depends. I mean, let's say you buy the bond today and you pay 100 for it and interest rates go down. Well, then the price of the bond will go up and you can sell it at a profit. So you can kind of speculate on bonds, and some people do that. And if
you're speculating on there is interest rate movement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the longer dated the bond is, the longer the loan is for, the more sensitive it is to interest rates. So for a 30-year bond, it's like a stock. You know, it's very volatile. Not as volatile as cryptocurrency, but still quite volatile. You know, 15%, 20% volatility. And of course, that's why everyone got completely hammered in 2022, because they had a lot of duration in their portfolios. It's called duration risk. But anyway, that's the kind of risk. If you've got a lot of duration in your bond, it's a long-dated bond, it's super sensitive to interest rates. If they move up, you lose money, a lot of money. And if they move down, you make a lot of money. So that's
why. Why would anyone buy long-duration bonds then at record low rates?
Well,
why were they buying?
I'm going to set the buzzer off now.
Go on.
Set it off. You
hit it.
Yeah, hit it.
I'm going to say the word convexity.
Complexity.
Convexity.
I know, but it's creating complexity in my head.
But I mean, one of the reasons you do it is because, one way to think about duration risk is if the duration of the bond is, say, 2 years, let's say, you buy it today for 100, you get a rate of 5%, you're feeling happy, right? You know, that's what you're going to get. But then the day after you buy it, interest rates go up by 1%. So that means you're going to lose out on
that 1%.
1% for 2 years.
You could have had that, yeah.
So the price of the bond will go down by 2%.
Okay.
Now, let's say there's a 10-year bond. You've locked in a fixed rate of 5% for 10 years. Well, now that bond's going to lose, for the same interest rate move, it's going to lose 10%. So that rough approximation is duration of the bond times the yield curve movement. That tells you the percentage price move of the bond. Now, there's a thing called convexity, because that's not quite right. What actually happens is if interest rates rise, the price doesn't go down quite as much as you'd expect. And if interest rates go down, the increase is a bit more than you'd expect. So the risk reward suddenly goes in your favor, because you gain more when yields fall than you lose when they rise. So that convexity makes the risk reward really tasty.
Is that always the case, the convexity?
Always. Oh, unless cool. You've got a special type of bond, which is something like a mortgage-backed security in the United States. So that's slightly different. But for a standard government bond, it's going to have positive convexity. And if you plot the price yield curve, that's because it kind of smiles. That's the way I think of it. So convexity is your friend if it's positive. Negative convexity is toxic. So don't do that. But anyway, a standard government bond has positive convexity, so the risk reward is really good. So if you buy a 30-year gilt, it's kind of in your favor. Of course, you'll lose money if yields rise, but not as much as you'd expect.
A gilt's a type of bond, right?
Yeah. A gilt is a bond issued by the UK government.
Yeah.
One issued by the US government is called a treasury, US treasury. Bills are around 10 years. Bills are kind of 1 year. And then you get bonds, which are about 10 years. And then each different maturity has a slightly different name.
Do you know what a German bond's called?
A Dachshund.
I think it's called a Bund, isn't it?
A Bund is a lot of the same one.
But
not only that, but then you've got Bobbles and you've got Schatz, which are kind of short term.
You've got Schatz.
I thought you'd like that.
That's quality. I like that. I want to hit the buzzer on that. What's a Schatz?
But they've all got different names, like, you know, Spanish ones, Bonos. Every different issuer has a different nickname.
It still doesn't make sense to me, though, like why, at say, near zero rates, someone would be like, I'm going to lock this rate in for 30 years, because surely they know interest rates had to go up.
In that case, you wouldn't lock it in. I mean, they were speculating. If you buy a bond at a negative yield, you're locking in a negative return. You're going to make a loss. So you'd never do that. What they were betting on was that yields would fall further, which for a long time they did.
Yeah, okay.
How do you buy a bond? Because I think when I was a kid, I might have, pretend not a kid, when I was younger, I think I bought one in the post office.
Really?
I think so.
Post office bond.
I think so. But you can't just buy them on the computer, online, can you?
You can. I mean, there are brokers that sell them. There aren't that many of them. If you're on Vanguard, the Vanguard UK platform, you can't buy them. But if you're an Interactive Investor, you can. AJ Bell, you can. Execution Only, XO is another UK platform where you can. Did I say AJ Bell? You can there. So, you know, there are several platforms where you can. And I think those are increasing all the time as people realise that they are interesting for more
especially
investors.
Especially with rates going up.
Exactly.
Like people, they're more attractive.
And right? I think as this cash flow planning tool, people realise that it's a really important part of your investing toolkit as you go through life, you know, if you have these planned expenses. So I think that's why the brokers are offering it. But to buy it, you just look up the ticker. So in the UK, they usually have tickers like T24, which means it's a UK Treasury, and it matures in 2024. And then you just look on the broker's website for your ticker, T24, up it pops. Now, usually they have a name which is based on their maturity date and their coupon. So it'll be called the 5% of 24, for example. And that'll be the 5% coupon which you get paid and then matures in 2024. So I think the way to think about a bond is you can think about it over its whole lifetime, right? So the day it's issued is its birthday. And then we've got the maturity date, its death date. What's kind of interesting is it's worth £100, $100, whatever, on its birthday and its death day. By definition, that's set in stone. So you buy it at 100. If you buy it on the day it's issued, you get the 100 back on maturity.
Cost you 100.
Because it's borrowing, right? That's the way borrowing works. You borrow 100, you get 100 back at maturity. So that's why it's always worth 100 at maturity. Because if you imagine that I'm going to pay you £100 tomorrow, what's it worth today? It's going to be worth very close to 100 quid. If it's like a month before, well, interest rates will start to factor because you could invest the 100 at some interest rate. But the day before, it'll just get closer and closer to 100.
Yeah, like a way of framing it is it's not the prices. You're giving them £100, they're giving you £100 at the end. So at the start, there's a transaction of 100 and you just get that back at the end.
And the value of that 100 in between can fluctuate.
Based on the rate that people can get on other bonds.
Could be the credit risk of the company as well. If the company looks like it's dodgy, the price could fall to 30 or 20 if it's distressed debt. Or if interest rates spike way above the coupon, if it's paying you 5% and interest rates are 10%, well, the price of the bond will tank. So the coupon is just additional to that capital gain. So the capital gain can be positive or negative depending on the price of the bond. If it's priced above 100, you get a capital loss. If it's below 100, you get a capital gain. And then you've got the coupon, which is always fixed for the whole life of the bond, 1%, 2%, whatever it is. And it's a percentage of the face value, the 100 that you get at maturity. The principal value, the par value is 100.
And the coupon they normally give you halfway through the investment or?
So for UK bonds, they pay every 6 months. So let's say the coupon's 5%. You bought 100 quid's worth. That's 5 quid a year interest you're going to get. But you get it in 250 chunks every 6 months. You know, you can think of it almost like a person because it's got a birth date when it was issued. It's got a death date when it matures. It's got a coupon, which is its kind of income. So if you imagine you're checking someone out on a dating app, you know, it has their salary, the coupon. It has when they're going to die, which is handy to know. Right? You don't get that.
Let me borrow a couple grand, darling.
So you know a lot about it the day you buy it. And you know exactly what you're going to earn if you hold it until it dies.
And like you say in there, just to re-clarify, these fluctuations of the price while you hold it are only really important if you're looking to sell it, say. You're still going to get exactly what you signed up for, but if you were, the price could drop in terms of what you could sell that for today.
So let's say you buy a one-year bond today on your Interactive Broker account. You buy it for £95. You know it's going to mature at 100 because they always mature at 100. That's the way it works. So you're going to make 5% over the next year, plus any coupon built into it. So let's say it's a 1% coupon bond. You're going to make a final coupon payment that's going to be on the day it matures, an interim one because they pay every 6 months. So you're going to get 0.5% in 6 months' time, 0.5% at maturity, and 5% capital gain. So you get 6% in total. And you know that the day you buy it. So you see the cash flows pop into your account, just like you would with a dividend on a stock. And then I was kind of nervous about this when I bought my first one. On the maturity date, you see the really chunky payment, the redemption payment, which is the 100. Because the coupons are usually tiny, you don't really care. But the final payment, you really care. And, you know, on the day it was scheduled to come into my account, it did. So I was relieved.
Yeah. With the RNS, which is like, we'll talk about the difference in a minute, but it takes a few days for that to come in. So there's a point where you fall into the negative, you know, in terms of like your return on the fund, which is like the money market fund. It's like this slope that goes up and then you fall off a cliff on the chart, but then I don't get the money through the broker for like 5 or 6 days. So
that's interesting. It's kind of like the dirty price of a bond, because bonds have two prices. They have a clean price and a dirty price. So let's say T sells me his bond, but it's 3 months into a 6 month coupon period. Well, he's held it for 3 years. It's only fair that I pay him half of his coupon. So what we add to the price of the bond is the accrued coupon, the 3 month half of the coupon. So, you know, that's just fair. And that's a dirty price. That's what you actually pay. But if you were to plot it, it would be this ugly rampy shape like you get with urns.
Yeah.
So what they always do is quote the clean price. So if you're ever looking up a bond price, that's the clean price. What you actually pay is a dirty price with the accrued coupon. That's one of the big things that people aren't used to with bonds. I mean, for stocks, you don't usually think about that.
It's almost like the dividend income being built in. And then, I mean, this does happen, but it's hard to see.
That's right.
But you would see, like, if you knew the dividend was coming up, you would see the share price tick up by the amount and then drop instantly at the point that they exit. And when you look at earns, the RNS, you see this slope. And you see the slope's getting bigger and bigger as interest rates have risen. And then I imagine it will come down so the slope will get smaller again.
Andrew Bailey's going to squash it.
Yeah, it's funny seeing how tiny the slope was, and now it's like these massive ramps.
Can you guess what the biggest learning has been from doing this podcast or even my YouTube channel? It's that the most important investment you can make is in you. So for me, my path to real wealth isn't through investing, it's by building this business. And that's why I'm happy that we're working with Hostinger. Hostinger help entrepreneurs, freelancers, and side hustlers with their websites. My favorite thing is their AI website builder, which helps anyone create a professional website with zero coding experience. You just describe your goal in a couple of sentences, and the AI creates a beautiful looking website just like magic. You can then customize it, use the AI assistant to generate SEO friendly text, and even use their AI logo maker. It's fast, user-friendly, and of course, what I like the best is it's great value for money. You can get website hosting and a free domain from £2.99 a month. So if you want a website, then check out Hostinger. And if you use the code MAKINGMONEY, that's making money all one word, you'll get 10% off. And I've left a link in the description for you. Before I became a creator, I was a sales guy. I mean, I love selling. It's how I rebuilt my life after some wrong turns in my 20s. I also delivered Chinese takeaways on the side, but that was more fun money, so I could go out on a night without feeling guilty. Sales was where the real money was at, and one tool that I found really useful was LinkedIn Sales Navigator. It's a sales intelligence platform that helps you identify and then get into conversations with high-value customers so you can drive more revenue. You can use it to look for key signals like recent job changes, so you can find buyers who are most likely to convert. And because they've got a billion people on the platform, I mean, the chances are your targets are going to be on LinkedIn. Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data so you can get into conversations with the people that matter. So if you want to give Sales Navigator a try, you can get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/upsell. That's linkedin.com/UPSELL for a 60-day free trial.
Okay, so you talked about individual bonds, and what you're saying there is like buying a bond, one loan, and then you've got bond funds that exist. Can you explain the differences?
Oh, I got so many questions about this, and it's so hard to understand, because if you buy a bond fund, what's in it? And the trouble is, you don't know. You don't know. I mean, you know today what's in it. So let's say we've got a bond fund, and what we're going to do, we've got £1 billion from our customers, and we're going to have to invest that in bonds. So what we do is we go out, we buy a portfolio of bonds, and then what's going to happen is, if money comes into the fund, we're going to have to buy more bonds. And if money flows out, we're going to have to sell some. So continually what's going on is we're churning the contents of the portfolio. The other thing with bonds is they mature. So as they mature, we're going to have to buy new ones. So you never really know what's going to be in the fund 1 month from now or 6 months from now or even a year from now, there's going to be a lot of change in the content. So the duration will be different. The coupon, the income, the average coupon will be different.
There's no certainty then?
None at all. No. So if interest rates go up, the price goes down. That still works. But the duration will change slightly. But it is true that it's interest rate sensitive. If interest rates rise, its value falls. If interest rates fall, its value rises. But the income's kind of unknown. So if we're just coming off a long period of low interest rates, a lot of the bonds are going to have those low coupons built in. So the income will be low. But then gradually what happens is, as those bonds mature, they're replaced with ones which have a higher coupon, and the income gradually picks up. So with the bond fund, approximately, if you think about it over your lifetime, let's say you buy a 10-year bond fund today and you just hold it for the rest of your life. What you'll earn roughly is just the income. The yields will rise and fall, but they never trend upwards and downwards forever. So long term, you earn the income. Short term, you've got an additional risk, which is the huge fluctuations from the yield curve, which drive the price up and down. And if you're unlucky and you have to sell at the point at which yield curves have risen, then you'll take the capital loss. So that's what I hate about bond funds. You don't have the control over when you sell them or when the what happens to the price. You don't know what you're going to get. And so I think as a hedge, they're not particularly good because you don't know what you're going to get. And if interest rates rise, then it's a problem.
If the benefit of a bond is the certainty and the bond fund removes that certainty over income, what's the point in a bond fund?
I think to some extent, they're less volatile than stocks.
Right.
So that's one of the benefits. If they have a shorter duration, they're super low volatility. And if it's ultra low duration, it'll be a money market fund, and they're as safe as you can get. So funds like Earns.
People don't think that though.
No.
We'll talk about that in a sec.
Bugbear. Anyway, so I think that, depending on the duration risk, you can control the risk to some extent. So if you go for a short-term bond fund, it'll have less duration risk. If you go for longer term, it's a bit more speculative, you know?
Yeah.
But what's weird is in the past, when stocks crashed, the ones which gained the most value were the long duration funds because they're more sensitive to interest rates. What didn't work, we can talk about this, I guess, in 2022 was that inflation was high. So this negative correlation between bonds and stocks, they move in opposite directions. So if stocks crash, usually what happens is bonds rally. But if inflation is the cause of the crash, well, it's toxic for stocks and it's toxic for bonds. It's like they're kryptonite. You know, if you've got a fixed rate of interest and inflation is higher than that, then you're earning negative coupons. So that's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, so, because you're locked at this place and the value of the currency is dropping. So it's just stripping the value out of that bond, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what's interesting, there was a paper that was published recently which talked about this bond equity correlation for your entire lifetime. So for someone like you or T, where you've got a 30-year period, the times when bonds don't help is when inflation spikes. And of course, that's what's happened recently. It's what happened in the 70s. So if you really need an equity hedge, equities really struggle most when there's very high inflation, sometimes with other crises. But the bond equity correlation over long periods of time is actually quite high. So they're not such good diversifiers as we thought. So I think people might have to rethink things like target date funds, about 60-40
portfolios.
Because over the long term, you know, over the short term, yeah, they hedge stock market falls usually. But long term, over, you know, 10-year periods, not so good. So many people, if you're on a workplace pension, you'll be just plonked into one of these 60-40 funds. If you use one of these robo-advisors, you'll answer some questions about risk, your appetite for risk, and they'll just plonk you into a portfolio, which is like, you know,
balanced. Call it. The balanced option is typically a 60-40, isn't
and
it?
Usually that will be 60-40. Maybe it'll be 80-20 or whatever, but variations of that. So it's just the default option for so many different funds. Advisors, financial advisors, often they do a risk questionnaire and they put you into one of these funds. So I think it's just so pervasive, this idea that, you know, your risk is determined by your equity bond split, and that's just the most important thing. Whereas if that's not true, I mean, that's a really big deal. I mean, that's foundational for so much of people's understanding of investment.
Vanguard was built on that kind of principle. Very much a defender of the 60-40.
And they're target date funds. Yeah. So the way they work is they have something called a glide path, where you start off with 80% stocks when you're a young lad, and then by the time you're 70, it's 30% stocks. So that glide path is that de-risking over time. And that's built around the idea that bonds are less crashy and safer. Whereas what it actually means, if this paper's right, is underperformance, less money handed on to your kids, and having to invest more to get the same benefits in retirement. So it is a big deal. It's not just a theoretical thing.
What do you think about... So I did some analysis recently of work-based auto-enrollment schemes, and I looked at the default fund options, and I was surprised at the bond allocations in those. So as an example, Nest... They have a grounding period, or whatever they call, which is for the first 5 years they de-risk. So the first 5 years you're in the fund in your 20s, basically because what they were saying was they didn't want any drops and people running away. And then they also de-risk 15 years before. So in an investing time horizon of 40 years is about 20 years of like tapping the brakes. How do you see that style of like bond allocation?
I think that would be... a really bad way of doing it. And I think these target date funds. Yeah, but target date funds do a very similar thing. Yeah. You know, you gradually de-risk through your life and then you end up at age 70 with like only 30% stocks. Whereas this recent paper that's been published, which actually looked at the back tests of, you know, how well does it do if you de-risk with a target date fund, is actually much better to just be internationally invested in equity. So 50% domestic, 50% international. And that actually does a better job of hedging than combining bonds with stocks. So they model their social security system and everything was US-based. So for them, international means non-US. So 50-50 made sense for them. But for Europe, probably, because it's a smaller market, you tilt more towards US and elsewhere. But what was interesting was the US on its own was not very good, because there's a kind of natural hedge built into your stock market via its currency. So let's say you have inflation spike in the UK, but not elsewhere. That devalues your currency. So when you convert your foreign stock value back into pounds, you get more pounds. And so that means that if inflation spikes, you've got this natural hedge to help you. So it's always good to have that foreign invested money because of that devaluation of your own currency if there's a bad time. Mm-hmm. So that's why international stocks did better, they think. But it's a really good hedge. And it actually had less ruin probability than combining stocks and bonds. So the risk of running out of money was lower. The terminal wealth, when you die, hand over to cash to your kids, was higher by having international stocks. And the wealth at retirement as well. So, you know, on all the metrics, it came out better, which shocked me, because all of these target date funds are built on this premise that, you know, hedging with bonds makes sense, but apparently not.
Why do they do it then?
I think the back test they do use monthly returns, which seems completely logical, right? You just say, well, what I'll do is I'll look at monthly returns on stocks and bonds, and I'll look at the correlation, and does it diversify? And yes, it does. Whereas if you look at 10-year blocks, this higher correlation between bonds and stocks is what's toxic. And that's what you see if you look over longer periods of time. And no one had done these simulations with this approach. It was something called Bootstrap Monte Carlo. Just see if you're awake, mate.
I understood all the words, but I was like, I don't know what they mean together. I'm like, I know what bootstrapping is. I know what Monte Carlo is.
Get into the casino on the cheap.
I started thinking about the casino, didn't I? What's Bootstrap Monte Carlo?
But the gist is, you just look at like blocks of time, long blocks of time rather than short months. And I think Vanguard simulated it with like monthly returns. So they didn't see the kind of toxic effect, whereas it's the long-term relationship between returns of assets which matters. So that's what was innovative about this paper, I think. I was really excited by it because I like things that kind of contradict what I believe.
Yeah.
And that was very much contradictory to what I believe.
Yeah. There's always this like, the 60-40 is dead. And what you're saying is it might actually be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll link the paper so that people can read it. The target date thing, just for people that aren't sure what that is, you set a target date, right? Then it's in the name. So you might have one that's a 2040. They normally have like the target date 2044 and 2050, 2060. And that's typically the date that you might retire, but the date that you think that you're going to need the money in the fund. And the ramp thing that you're talking about is the de-risking towards that date. So by the time you hit that date, you're typically all cash or all bonds, or you're out the market completely and you've just got a pot of money there.
That's right. And the important thing to understand is they don't mature. So they carry on existing. So you can still buy the Vanguard 2015 retirement fund because it's just lots. It just contains lots of bonds. You know, it doesn't have many stocks in it. So these things continue to exist and they continue to have value. And the idea is you just sell a little bit of it and live off the proceeds.
Yeah, and it's important again to understand this, because from the pension research that I did, most strategies are target date or they're de-risking. And a lot of them are decided by your employer, not the pension company. So the pension company sits down with your employer and probably says, we've got this option or this option, which one do you want? And they go, well, which is the cheapest for us? Which is the best? What do you recommend? We'll take that. And they've made a decision there about how much risk you're going to take, what bond allocation you'll have. And most importantly, what kind of product you might buy at retirement. You'll see them and it's like target date 2040 annuity. And the fund is set up for someone that wants to buy an annuity at retirement. I don't think many people nowadays would be doing that. And they might take their 25%, and people really need to have this conversation with themselves and look at their pensions, and because that's their biggest exposure to bonds, even if they don't like it.
I think the problem is that most people just don't care. Yeah, you know, they don't care. They don't want to understand it, and they don't want to understand the bonds in particular. And so, you know, explaining something like a target date retirement fund is just not going to make any sense to them. So that's why these default options exist. So I think from the point of view of the fund managers, the job is to find something which is going to work pretty well for most people most of the time. But what this paper shows is that that's not 60-40.
Yeah. So I read a really good paper on this. It's called Death by Default. And it looks at this like point of, so with Nest, 99% of people are in their default fund. So what you have is a broad range of 18 to 60 year olds with varying degrees of risk profile. So they skew balanced. But when you do an individual test with someone, they go a little bit more adventurous.
Yeah.
And they modeled the difference in returns between balanced and slightly more adventurous. We're talking 20% more risk, you know, so a not like balls to the wall, just a little bit more risk.
Yeah.
They balanced like bear market, normal market and bull. And the only case where the more risk lost was in the bear market, like in the worst case. And in retirement, they talked about how much income you would have. And the difference in income was about £800 a year between like in this. But in the bull case, the difference in income between the standard default fund and this slightly more risky was £15,000 a year.
A year.
It's a big difference.
Income. So you're talking like hundreds of thousands of pounds of value. And only out of the 9 modeled examples, only in one example did this default fund actually perform better than the rest. So if the market just performed as average, you're talking an extra £5,000 to £6,000 a year in income by going, no, I don't want to be balanced. I just want the slightly more risky. And it was a difference between 60-40 and 80-20. It wasn't even 100% equity.
I think the stat that surprised me was that ruin probability. It's actually not that high for stocks, because stocks, although they do crash, they bounce back fast.
Yeah.
You just look at 2020, that was an unusual one, but it returned.
Within a few months.
Yeah. I mean, it just completely turned around. Same in 2008. It turned around pretty quickly. That was probably, you know, I think it was around 7 years for that to recover, which was painful at the time, but you carry on investing through those periods. So you get really chunky returns after it's crashed. So it's only if you're in retirement that these crashes really are a huge problem.
What's the like reasoning behind people in their 20s having 80-20, for example, or like having not being 100% in equities? Why do they think that you should have some bonds in your 20s in their 60-40 fund?
I think some of it is cognitive. So if you see that, okay, you put the money in first month and you see it crash by 20%,
you start paying it.
Yeah, okay. I think that's the worry. And people have got to stick with these things. So I think for people who don't understand markets and that they do recover, that can be a problem.
Yeah, that's true.
I think what people need to realize is these pension providers are in the business of charging you a fee over your lifetime. So they've got a very vested interest in making sure that you're in their funds.
Yeah.
They also would like you to perform very well because they get a bigger share than percentage-wise. But I think for a Nest, it's like, let's just make sure the 20-year-old stays in the fund rather than burns it. So they'll just dial the risk right down. So you see, oh, the £1,000 that I paid in over the year has gone up by 50 quid. That's great. Like you don't realize that's a massive underperformance versus the
rest. That's actually kind of clever. Yeah, I think.
It is clever, but it's also...
it's going to hurt their wealth.
It's
going to hurt your personal wealth when you're coming to retirement.
It's like second order thinking, because if they just stop paying in, that'll be much worse.
Yeah.
Because you'd rather have them for the whole life.
Psychological nudging. They use nudges. What they should actually say to them is, you know, in their 20s, they should sit them down and go, you need to take as much risk as possible right now. Because if you look at someone in your position, if they do 100% equity, this is where they end up. Whereas if they do this conservative approach, this is where they end up. They should educate and inform rather than go, let's manipulate them into staking into the fund, because they don't understand it and the plebs don't need to know. We'll take our 1.8% contribution fee for the admin cost and then 0.5% a year, which is what I think they charge, which is ludicrous fees. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but enough of that. I had a massive rant on my channel. I'm not happy. And I expect an email from Nest at some point going, oh, we'd like you to come in and have a chat. Can we talk about 2022 in more detail? Because I think the narrative that most people would have is like bonds are more secure than equities. They're like safer, less risky. But then people just got wiped out, didn't they, in 2022? And I don't really know why. I don't think people understand why, and I don't think they understand why Liz Truss and Kwarteng had to do with that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I got pretty angry about that. Yeah. And I don't usually get angry. I'm not an angry man.
No, but I remember your rant video. I loved it.
I was a bit ranty. Yeah. But I think the reason was because governments, when they issue debt, they have to be responsible. So think of it like issuing, you know, pieces of paper which have a value which you force people to create for them. And if you issue too many of those pieces of paper and you don't warn the market it's coming, well, the value of those pieces of paper will go down. That's effectively what they did. They telegraphed their plans very poorly. Plus, it was at a time of really high inflation. So issuing lots of debt at a time of high inflation in order to stimulate the economy was itself inflationary. And they didn't listen to experts. And essentially, over 1 week period, we had the biggest sell-off, or the biggest increase in yields ever for the UK market. And this is one which has been around for centuries. So I think that was so irresponsible. You know, they paid the price politically. They're seen as incompetent now, I think, by many people.
Yeah.
You just look at the polls. And I think governments have to be responsible. And to a certain extent, you know, people still need to buy gilts. People still like gilts. I like them. If they do crash, I'll buy more. You know, so I kind of like these crashes. But I think that was incredibly irresponsible, because we're still paying the price today. You know, people are paying more on their mortgages today. People are paying more for any kind of borrowing. So I think it was very irresponsible.
What sort of impact, like in percentage wise, did it have? You know, how much extra are people paying on their mortgages as a result of that mini budget?
Well, if you look at the yields themselves, I think they increased by about, I mean, this doesn't sound like much, but by about 2 percentage points.
That's a lot.
Over the course of a very short period of time. So if you think about, you know, if you have a 30-year bond, that's going to have a duration of about 20 years. So 20 times 2 is 40%. So over a very short period of time, you get these huge sell-offs in these long maturity bonds. And if you imagine that you're a pension fund and you've got certain hedges in place, you price in a certain worst-case scenario, assuming the government's not an idiot. But that didn't work. And a lot of them became insolvent due to something called LDI. This is a way of hedging the interest rate risk. But those assumptions didn't work because they were so incompetent.
I mean, if you talk about 2% on your mortgage, people know how much that extra that would cost them. You're talking like hundreds a month in extra cost on your mortgage.
For so many millions of people. Yeah. And so I think that's why politically they're seen as incompetent now, because they were the party of
the
business.
Economically sensible party, right?
In theory.
And they destroyed that reputation.
I think so.
And nonetheless,
it's going to take a generation, I think, for them to reclaim that mantle of being a kind of safe party.
Let's flip it onto Labour then, because I'd be interested. I heard that obviously Labour have a reputation of spending, right? And I heard that they would fund that through bond issuance. So can you explain what that would do, and why wouldn't that cause inflation?
Well, to a certain extent, inflation is now coming down, so we've got a bit more wiggle room. We're not at the kind of peaks that we were at, and the prints are coming down. Recently, we had a print that went up a bit, but I think that was just a blip. So inflation's not as bad as it was, so there's more wiggle room in terms of issuance and stimulating the economy. Now, the Conservative government's going to be stimulating as well, so you know, I don't think that makes much difference between the parties. But you're right, typically Labour spend more on services, education, and that has to be paid for somehow. And if they haven't got, you know, more growth, then what can they do? They can only plug the difference with debt. So if they issue a lot of debt, that's going to be a problem because it increases our debt to GDP ratio. So if you think the GDP is a country's income, the amount of debt relative to GDP, the toxic point usually, I mean, people argue about this, is about 100%. We're currently, I think, well below that. The US is well above, it's 120. Japan's at something crazy like 250% of GDP. So, you know, people...
Go on, Japan.
Yeah, slap it on the Alex, give me shit and pay it in the morning.
But everyone, when they say that debt to GDP is really worrying, you always give them the example of Japan, which is okay, basically, at the moment.
And people like it there. Like, you know, it's seen as a nice place.
They've got the toilets that sing songs to you and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, they always seem to me to be the guys like experimenting with policy the most. You know, like doing the wild things. Like when it was like we were talking about quantitative easing and tightening, that it was like, there are no examples of this, apart from in Japan. Like they were always like the people that lead from the front in terms of crazy maneuvers.
Yeah, they bought stocks. Crazy, yeah. Right? I mean, you wouldn't have thought the central bank would end up doing that. But then the US central bank, the Fed, they ended up buying junk bonds. So this time around in 2020, when we had the big crash. So I think other banks are taking on some of their ideas rather than the other way around. But yeah, no one seems to be in big trouble yet. But to be fair, they haven't raised interest rates there yet. They're still at their zero bound. You look at any other central bank and rates have just chugged upwards really aggressively. Japan, no.
What's the inflation like there?
I think they're just getting back to inflation, which is what they were trying to do for 20 years. Yeah. But you know, the demographics there are just appalling. Yeah. It's like a 50% dependency ratio, which is the proportion of people in work relative to people who've retired. So much higher than other places. So
they have an aging population.
Aging population. Yeah. Immigration, I think, is about zero. Literally over the
net
last
net migration kind of
like net the, migration yeah, yeah. is very small, so they have very few people being added to their population.
And the, you know, like there's a lot of stuff there about like the men not engaging and not having babies, basically. And the younger generations there, you know, they're a lot more in the computers, aren't they? Basically.
Yeah, rather play a video game than have babies, which you know, in retrospect.
I mean,
no, that's not true.
It's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
I play video games with my baby now. So we've gone full circle. Me and my son absolutely smoking.
My son did all the boss battles, and I'm grateful to him for that.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so it's interesting, though, how the bonds intersect with the politics. And, like, you know, you could have a little piece of like an IOU, but you also need to look at the bonds from a political perspective, and like they move the country in a certain direction through the issuance of these bonds. They make the world go round, as I think you said.
I think they do. And I think certain bond markets, which we don't have in the UK, could transform the UK's economy.
Is this your municipal bonds that you talked about?
Municipal bonds. Because let's imagine that all the government has to do here is say, let's say that you buy a municipal bond. It would fund things like your local library, your local fire service, your ambulance service, your universities, whatever, locally, your potholes in the road. And the idea is it's kind of like a voluntary tax. What's the benefit to you as a local resident? Well, firstly, you don't have to pay tax on it. That's the bit the government does. They ensure that the tax laws favour it. And then secondly, you have a kind of feel-good factor that you're funding your local community. And you know what you're funding as well. Usually these are tied to a particular project, maybe some infrastructure. So I think that could really transform the UK. And it requires very little effort from the UK government. All they've got to do is just do this tax thing where reduced taxes or even better, no taxes on those bonds would be all you'd need to set it up.
If you could salary sacrifice into local projects.
Yeah.
Because you would effectively like skill up the whole, it would be like that investment through that. But you just basically say to people, you either pay it as tax or you can direct it into municipal bonds. Like for me, I would direct money into a fund that put fast internet where I live.
Yeah.
Because it's just
Why
not
wouldn't
there.
You? Yeah. And potholes. If you feel strongly about potholes, well, buy the municipal bond. And you can actually get people maybe to lobby for these things to be done. And then the funding's there.
Are these municipal bonds currently active?
Oh, in America, yeah.
Where in the world are they
available? Well, I know the US has them. I know that Canada has them as well. And they use these for public projects all the time. So I think from that point of view, they're quite a transformative bond market, which we just don't have.
Would you get, you get your money back as well?
Oh, yeah. So it's a standard bond. Wow. So let's say on day one, you want to build a library. Well, you have to break ground on the site. You have to have the cash up front. So they issue a bond. They get, I don't know, 20 million, 30 million to build it. And then you get a coupon, which is then paid off over some period of time. So the bond would mature in 10 years and you get a fat coupon because it is not risk-free. I mean, you can have these local authorities going bust. We've seen Birmingham. It in the UK. Yeah, Birmingham's gone bust. And so they can default on the debt.
So I want to bring this back to investing now again. There's the bond in terms of like a savings account and you use it. But there's, you talked about long-term, short-term, et cetera. I want to have the conversation around the ultra-short, which is what I do, ERNS. Can we talk about like the risks there, the perceived risks and the benefits? So for you, Tamane, this is a great way to access high interest rates on cash savings, much better than the banks offer typically.
Yeah. So at the moment, with short-term interest rates being super high, these money market funds, what they invest in is really, really safe stuff. So if you can think of boring, it's like boring squared. That's what you get with one of these money market funds. So the deal is, if it's one of these ones that pays an income like yours earns, it's always worth a quid. So you might be thinking, why would you ever invest in something which is always worth £1? It seems crazy. It does fluctuate slightly, but it's worth a pound. The idea is that it pays you this regular interest, which is based on this kind of short-term interest rate. So you can milk that short-term interest rate with zero volatility. So if you put a pound in, you can always take a pound out. So if you've got your kids' university money, it'll always be there. If you have to buy a house in a year's time and you need the deposit,
it's my tax money I put in it.
It'll always be there. Or if you're a company, a good example, corporate tax, it's a great place to park your money. So companies use these all the time as a temporary place to park their money. So what do you earn with it? Well, you earn the ultra short interest rate. That's roughly what you'd get with like 1 month UK gilts. They also invest in things like commercial paper. This is like a short-term IOU from a company. So let's say a company wants to borrow for 180 days. They'll issue one of these commercial paper notes. And so very short maturity, very little interest rate risk, very little credit risk. They're often very high quality issuers. So very low risk, short-term investment. And, you know, you'll get some kind of credit spread on those, not much. But those are higher risk and give you a slightly higher income. And also things like deposits with banks, they can do that in a structured form called certificates of deposit. So those are the kinds of investments, all ultra safe, low credit risk, low duration risk, boring, low interest rate. But at the moment, very high interest rate, because you'll get more interest on that money market fund than you would for a 1 year, 2 year, all the way up to 30-year UK gilt. So big income, almost no risk. So it's kind of like a no-brainer at the moment.
Yeah.
You're being paid to take less risk, which is very weird.
So like, I think it's about 5.6% it works out to at the minute that I get. And they, you know, it like, you just see it ratchet up in price and then it pays that to you as an income. And every time the central bank rate went up, the rate went up instantly.
How often does it pay you?
I think it's every 6 months I get a
pay. For that one, yeah, which I think is a lousy design.
Yeah.
The Vanguard one pays you monthly.
Yeah.
And there's another one which is popular with the pension crafters, which is like a, it's called CSH2. Mm. And that's issued by Amundi. And that pays you via capital gain. So you just see its price steadily increase, which I think is more understandable than something which kind of ramps up and down and pays you coupons.
Just love that notification though. And you know, when you're talking, let's say my tax bill might be like, because I put my income tax in there and that could be like, you know, 20K say, and I've got to build that up for a whole year and I'm getting 5.6% on that. Do the math. It's a chunky amount of just extra money, you know, and it helps you get there. But when does that narrative change then? So when would I be going, this is no longer worth it for me?
Well, the big example was what happened in 2008. And one of the biggest US money market funds went bust. And it was called the Prime Fund. And what actually happened
doesn't
was...
Doesn't sound very low risk, Roman.
Wasn't then.
My tax bill here.
What happened is they bought commercial paper, a chunky amount of it, but from a bank you can probably guess the name of.
Lehman?
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately.
I was thinking, there's a lot of banks. Oh, yeah, 2008 makes sense. Yeah.
So, you know, all of that paper essentially became worthless overnight. So they were left holding worthless paper. The people were pulling their money out of the fund, so they had huge redemptions. And of course, if people are pulling their money out, they have to sell the stuff they've bought. So they sell the liquid stuff, the usual kind of liquidity spiral that you'd expect. And the commercial paper market effectively froze up because people, money market funds, couldn't sell this stuff fast enough. So you can have the commercial paper market run into these liquidity problems. But central banks know this. And if they see the first sign of that market freezing up, my guess is that they'll probably do something. They'll do something to ensure that the liquidity is there. Maybe not direct loans, but indirect loans like the...
Or just reassure it. Yeah. They just say, we are here and we will foot the bill.
We're a borrower of last resort. We'll buy that paper off you temporarily.
Yeah.
And that way, they'll get their money back because they don't really care anyway, but it's all made up money from their point of view. But that way, it puts confidence back into the market. So I think, you know, to restore confidence in that market would be fairly easy for the central bank. I think to do the kind of kamikaze approach, which is to say, no, we're going to let it burn. You know, that's not going to happen. I don't think even Andrew Bailey would do that.
No, because when we did our live, I said my only exposure to bonds is through that fund. And people were like, whoa, that's too risky, that. And then I saw you make the video of, are money market funds risky? So is that the risk that people are talking about, that 2008 risk?
That's what people worry about. And it's the commercial paper part of it that people worry about. It's not the government bonds. I think a government... You know, we're still paying the moron premium in UK gilt, but no government would be so moronic as to actually default on
UK
debt. What's
the moron premium?
The moron premium is that huge spike we got in UK gilt.
Oh, okay. So that's what you call it.
They call it the moron premium.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're still paying that to some extent. But I think any government, they're going to be paying that moron premium for generations. Like if the UK government defaulted on its debt, because that's the kind of bedrock. You know, like if you build a Lego model, you've got the kind of base plates that you build everything on, and then you kind of layer everything on top of that. Well, the kind of government bonds are like the base plate for the Lego model. If you take that away, the whole thing's going to collapse. And so every other asset has to be repriced because interest rates are now higher, which is what happened in the UK. It didn't just affect the UK market. It sent shockwaves through the entire fixed income market, into the equity market, because everything has to reprice if rates are higher. Those risk-free rates. So, you know, making that mistake would be, you know, it would get a party out of power for a generation.
Yeah.
If they did that. So I think most governments are aware of that and they wouldn't do it unless they are bonkers. And it was interesting, Donald Trump was actually talking about defaulting on US debt and saying it would be kind of okay. And I was thinking, no, it really won't be okay. You know, that's probably the safest and biggest debt market on the planet. So shaking that one up would have just been catastrophic. So let's just hope, you know, the sanity stays in place.
He looks like he might get back in, so maybe he'll have another shot.
Well, let's hope that the debt ceiling debates don't get too close to the wire, because that's when they usually threaten to say, oh, fine, just let it default.
Forget it. Yeah.
It'll be okay.
So we talked about money market bonds earlier?
Bonds.
Is that money market funds earlier? Are they just essentially really short-term bonds, and how do they work? And when I say short-term, how long is that short-term?
So on average, let's take the Vanguard UK money market fund, for example. If you look at the average lifetime of the debt, which is inside that fund, it's 30 days.
Wow.
So let's say that lots of people started pulling out their money and the fund got gated because you couldn't pull your money out because they couldn't sell the stuff fast enough. All you've got to do is wait a month and the stuff's going to mature. So it's very, very short term. And ultra short term means almost no interest rate risk. It's almost cash-like.
So but their returns are, it's annual return? Well, I noticed it's monthly, but is it 5%? Per annum?
Yeah. Well, at the minute.
And then you get it.
Roughly, it tracks something which has a rather cute name. It's called the SONIA rate. Oh. So it stands for Sterling Overnight Index Average. Not so cute, but nice name, right? But that's roughly the rate at which banks lend to one another. And that's roughly what you earn, which itself is very closely linked to the Bank of England's bank rate.
Mm.
So if that's 5.25, then SONIA will be about 5.25, and so will the return on your money market funds. So just by watching SONIA, you know what you're going to earn roughly.
And the benefit of the money market fund is that you get the rate adjustments quickly. So when the Bank of England were increasing the rate, you saw that reflected in the fund straight away, whereas your bank were like, oh, we'll still give you 2%, you know, on a savings account. And they were benefiting from that rate by lending your money out. And there was that big controversy really about them not passing the rates on. So with the money market fund, you get that quick straight access. Away. So in a time of inflation, when you know rates are ratcheting up, it's quite useful to have that because you're going to get access to that rate immediately.
And then they give you all your capital back at the end of the month and then you can reinvest, or do they just give you your
return? So it depends on the makeup of the fund. But with the one I get, you almost get like a dividend. So you see the price of the fund raise like this, which is the interest building up as such, and then it drops in value and then you get a cash chunk in your bank.
And then same thing.
You can then reinvest that if you want.
And it's very liquid, so you can sell it anytime you want. Yeah. Unlike a fixed term deposit with your bank where you're locked in for 2 years or whatever, and you get a penalty if you have to sell it beforehand, or if you can even sell it.
And because it's, let's say if it pays out once every month for ease of example, and it starts at £1 and it's going to end at £1.05, but you sell 15 days in, you'll sell and get £1, you get like £1.25 because the price will have risen to that point. So you still get your money even if you sell out. You don't have to wait for maturity.
It's like our accrued coupon example where I was paying you what you
were owed. Exactly. Yeah. So it's rising in value to basically represent the money you would have earned. So
it's the dirty price.
Yeah, the dirty price. Yeah, the dirty price. But it feels so good.
You see, bonds are sexy. There's all sorts of things. Dirty price.
Sonia's dirty price.
So I buy my money market fund on Trading 212. You can buy them on, and most brokers have their own versions. Like you say, Vanguard have a specific one, but yeah, like most brokers have them.
Would they be called money market funds?
Some of them are wrapped as ETFs. So you can buy that on any ETF platform. CSH2 is a popular one. This is the one issued by Amundi. And there are others which have a fund form. So it's an open-ended investment company.
And you can buy them inside of an ISA. And things like this.
Yeah, inside an ISA, inside a SIP. So it's really useful from that point of view, because if you want to switch out quickly, if stocks look like they're about to rally, you can do that so fast because you can sell the thing and switch into something else almost immediately.
So for me, my cash comes in spurts. I want to fill out my ISA, but I want to, you know, pound cost average into the market on a consistent basis. I can stick that money inside my ISA. You know, the big chunk, have it inside one of these money market funds generating a return, and then just sell off each month and invest a fixed percentage. So I know that markets long term trundle up, but I just like investing on a consistent basis each month, you know? So rather than just slap in, say, 20K into the market in one day, I can like spread it out, but still generate a return inside of the ISA and not lose the ISA allowance. And then, tax, which brings on, there's obviously no tax inside of an ISA, but is the tax, is it capital gains? Is it income tax? Is it a dividend? How are taxed on bonds?
So bonds are kind of special if you look at gilts in the UK, and this isn't true for other countries. It's special about the UK. The government gives you a kind of break for voluntarily giving them money, which is that you don't pay tax on the capital gain. Okay, so that's the way it works. You do pay tax on the, as a kind of savings income, on the coupon of the bond. So throwing our minds back to what you get with the bond, if you buy it at £95 today, it matures at 100 in a year's time, then that 5% is capital gain. You are not taxed on that, even if it's outside an ISA or a SIP, and you can buy in unlimited amounts.
So we've got bonds in terms of as a vehicle for saving for something. I want a car in 2 years. Here's a bond. We've got the short-term ones, which are like ERNS and these kind of things that I use, the money market funds for access to the basically the central bank rate at a quick rate. What about, you talked about de-risking and approaching retirement. Can you talk about how someone that's listening now thinking, you know, I'm 5 years off retirement, how would they use bonds there?
So what I'm planning to do, and this is something I shared with my community in fair amount of detail, but what I'm planning to do is to start something called a bond ladder. And it sounds fancy, but really the only idea behind it is that instead of just buying one bond, which matures in a year, you buy two bonds, one that matures in a year, one that matures in 2 years. And that way the rungs of the ladder are the maturity dates. So that's got two rungs, but you can have, you know, 10 rungs, 20 rungs, however many you want. And then when one of the bonds matures, you just buy another one. So it's like a conveyor belt where you're just buying another one. And I'll probably run that for 5 years before retirement and carry on running it for like 5 years after retirement. And then when I'm thinking how much money to put into it, I'll take my annual living expenses, multiply by three, and that's how much I'll put into my ladder. So it'll be like a 3-year ladder. 5 years before I retire, I'll set it up. And then gradually after, you know, 2 years into retirement, I'll just stop reinvesting when one matures. And then if there is a crash, I can always sell one of those bonds and, you know, use that to live off and let stocks recover, you know, while I'm living off the bonds. So that's the plan.
Yeah.
So that's one way you can do it. Another way is simply to have a constant allocation to bonds for some period of time through your retirement. If you can't weather 100% equity, which is what I'm going to have for most of my retirement, if you're not comfortable with that, then having, I don't know, 20% in bonds or whatever it is you want through single gilts is pretty easy to do. The bond ladder, you only have to do things when it matures and just buy another one. So I think, you know, to maintain them is pretty easy. So that's probably what most people could do in retirement. Not many people do that in the UK because we're just not very fixed income savvy here. In America, they're all over it. So they build their bond ladders with municipal bonds, of course, because they're so tax efficient, but also US treasuries. And there are tools they've got on Fidelity's platform, which let them build the bond ladders, work out the yield, all of that. So no, I think there'll be more online platforms that let you do that in an automated way in future, because it's just a really useful thing to do.
So can we just sum up like where bonds would be useful for people at different age groups?
Sure. So let's say you're 20, right? So at this point in life, you're probably thinking about saving up for a house, maybe a car, in order to get around. So if you've got those big expenses, then you could put money maybe into a money market fund if interest rates are fairly high at the short end of the curve like they are now. If they're not, then you could think about, say, you know, saving up for a year or so and buying a 1-year gilt, for example. Then in your 30s, maybe you're thinking now you've got a partner, you've got children, you're thinking about those children's big expenses. For example, you could be paying for their lavish presents. You could have to save up for that for some period of time. So again, money market funds and gilts might be another way of doing that. Or if they're going to university, when you're in your 40s, you're probably thinking the kids are going to have a wad of cash to pay for it rather than getting into debt. So why not buy debt in order to get them out of debt? You know, so all of these things, you know, retirement, when you're in your 60s, you'll be thinking about de-risking. And I talked about having a bond ladder at that point. So all through life, I think there are events when these bonds become really useful. And of course, they've got the kind of transformative aspect, which is things like municipal bonds, which can really change society,
your community in local settings.
Absolutely.
You should make a video on this, like how to use bonds to get rich at every age, by age, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
You're never going to get rich with them, but I think you can, yeah, you can the use
title.
Them.
Yeah. Click
them. I'm joking. We don't do that. We've got cameras here so they can see you. I know that.
Here at Mindset Win, we want to give you the tools to become better at what you do.
Taking inspiration and wisdom from our guests, we will hear stories, strategies, tips, and tricks.
Told by leading names in sport and beyond.
Who know what it takes to get to the very top.
There will be 2 episodes each week, packed with amazing stories and practical takeaways for us all to follow.
Search for Mindset Win on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app.
If you want a bullet point summary of this episode, you can sign up to our newsletter using the link in the description.
And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. It really makes a difference and lets us know that we're doing a good job.
And remember, this is not financial advice. Like we say a lot on the podcast, investments can fall and rise. In fact, it's almost a guarantee. Remember, past performance is no guarantee of future results, so your money is at risk with investing. Also, remember other fees may apply. I'm Damo.
I'm T.
This episode was recorded by Jack Hobbs. Music is by Felix Taylor. It was produced and edited by Ruth Edwards. Johnny Hunter is in charge of marketing, and it's all brought together by Will Stollerman.